Ezio Pinza is buried in Greenwich. Catherine de Medici was so fond of spinach that she had it served at every meal. Some claims made by Popeye were not strictly real. Catherine was from Florence, so spinach is Florentine. From medieval Venice, we get the word quarantine. It comes from a term meaning 40 days. Is this useful to know? Well, who's to say? Everything is miscellaneous. The hypodermis is subcutaneous, and that might seem extraneous unless you're a whale. What we know is multifarious. In blindfold tests, a Stradivarius is played with other various violins. Experts fail. And that is the theme of our show on this day. Here is the host, I've heard him say. He's a distant relation to Gideon Wells. If I knew who that was, I'm sure it would be swell. Colin McEnroe. Oh, Colin McEnroe. Oh.
You know, it is actually, first of all, I'm very moved by that song. And in researching the lyric for that song, I did discover that for all the fuss that is made about Stradivarius instruments, in fact, when they are subjected to blindfold studies and things like that, nobody can really tell the difference. The experts can't tell the difference between that and another really good violin or cello or viola. They're not all violins. See, this would be an example of miscellaneous knowledge. And I acquired this miscellaneous knowledge, plus a lot more miscellaneous knowledge about Stradivarii just today because I was helping write this song. And to me, that's the allure. That's the mystique of miscellaneous information, of useless information, whatever it is we're going to call it. And I should say that we initially decided that we were going to do this show partly because we'd been sent some information about a new book that was out. And it's part of a long chain of books that at least goes back to the Wallace and Wallachinsky families who used to put out all these compendiums of kind of random information. And they're meant – and this one was exclusively and explicitly intended for consumption while sitting on the toilet. And the whole idea is you sit on the toilet, you have a fixed amount of time, as it were, and you know, you want to be dealing with things and you don't want to be making a big commitment. You're not going to read a Margaret Atwood novel on the toilet, so you're going to read these little chunks of information and then do your business and then move on. And I don't like those books. I really don't like them. I love useless information. I love miscellanea. But something about collecting them up that way seems to me to – well, it offends me in some way that I don't completely understand. But I'm hoping by the end of today's show I will understand why that offends me and why, on the other hand, I'm extraordinarily fond of useless information, which I acquire over the course of just researching things or reading about things or wanting to know a little bit more about this thing or that. So to help us understand all of this, we have a wonderful lineup of guests for you today, and we'd love to hear from you too. If you're a fan of miscellanea, if you're a fan of useless information, whatever you want to call it. I hate the word trivia too, because I mean there are things which are trivia, but information that doesn't really have it, that's not easily categorizable or doesn't really fit into any overarching mission that you have, is not necessarily trivial. Anyway, our number, if you want to call in, 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. So we're going to start off here. Well, let me tell you who's with us as we go along here. Several people who have been on our show many times. Deb Amlin, who's a humorist for the New York Times, writes their Wordplay blog, has a new venture coming up, which we'll tell you about, too. Steve Silverman, he's actually new to our show, a high school science teacher, author of Einstein's Refrigerator, and he records the Useless Information podcast. And then joining us also a little bit later in the show, David Weinberger, I think is making his third appearance, I think, on the show, the author of, among other books, Everything is Miscellaneous, and he's the co-director of the Harvard Library Innovation Lab. So all of that is to come. We're going to start out with Jessamyn West. Jessamyn West is the director of operations at Metafilter and does community and technology work in Randolph, Vermont. She's as famous a librarian as a famous librarian could possibly be. She's going to sort of help us get this conversation going. So, Jessamyn, I'm going to sort of talk to you on a number of different levels, sort of pertaining to the different hats that you wear. But let's talk to you with your librarian hat on for a second. I mean, something tells me that some librarians would be disturbed or at least somewhat displeased by the notion of miscellanea, that really ultimately in library sciences, what you want to be able to do is categorize things, right? Get the information that belongs together. So miscellanea represents implicitly something having gone wrong. How do you react to that statement?
Well, I think you're right about the categorization. I mean, co-locating is sort of what we do, how you put all the Bibles next to each other or all the books about cooking next to each other. But I view Miss Linnea personally as more of a challenge for that. You know, you had people like Dewey who wanted to break everything down into 10 categories divided by subcategories and thought you could have a book that had all the categories in it. This was fallacious, of course. But I do think we still like to lump things together. I mean, like they say in evolution, there's lumpers and splits, and I think bird watching also.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we like to try and find ways to stick things with other things. And so even something that's miscellaneous, I mean, at the very least, it goes with the other miscellaneous things. I think that's why a lot of us like, I don't know if I speak for everybody, but like the trivia heading, because that's where all those little odds and ends and bits and bobbles can all go together and be with their kind, I guess.
You know, Jessamyn West, we're going to come back to this, too, when we're talking to David Weinberger, because, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of his work sort of suggests that because so much historic library cataloging has to do with physical space, and because we now live in digital space, the whole game has kind of changed radically. But we can come back to that idea. I'm going to have you take off your librarian hat, put on your Metafilter hat. First of all, for people who have never had the joy of Metafilter, explain what that is.
Well, Metafilter is a massive group blog. It's been around since the late 90s, and it's basically a blog format website where anybody who's a member, and we've got several tens and thousands of members, can make posts, basically just write an entry on something that interests them. It's a blog format, so it's just text, and then other people can sort of talk about it in the comments in blog format. I think people are maybe familiar with sort of big popular blogs that do similar things like this, like Boing Boing, for instance, or there's a lot of political blogs, Huffington Post, Daily Kos, or whatever. But we're one of those sort of old school, low tech, anyone can post things that interest you. And this may be current YouTube videos, or it may be, you know, historical things you've dug up on the internet. Our only requirement is it can't be something that you made yourself. And it's got to be something on the internet. So a link to something, a link to a video, a song, some other story, what have you. We have a big Q&A part of the site, too, where people can ask and answer questions. That's slightly different than, I think, Metafilter's original goal, which was let's find a way to share neat stuff on the internet that we find with each other and then talk about it.
And I'm somebody who visits Metafilter pretty regularly, although I'm not a contributor or anything like that. And I would say that you go to if you're really interested in the Civil War, then you go to websites that are about the Civil War. You go to a site like Metafilter when you don't really know what it is you're interested in. You want to be told on a given day as a result of the random activity of a very uncoordinated group of thinkers and writers what conceivably might be interesting. It is that sort of, you know, do I feel lucky slot machine approach to, as a consumer anyway. I'm being told.
Yeah, well, in the library world, we think of this sort of a discovery layer. There's too much stuff now, and people need help filtering it to find the stuff that is relevant to them. And so I think the only thing a lot of these people share is that they're interested in the internet.
Do you find that you walk away from either Metafilter or other parts of your job with all kinds of useless information in your head that by the same token remains to you fairly precious or exciting for some reason?
Sure. I mean, I think for many grown-ups, learning something new every day is something that makes you feel like you've still got your hand in, that your brain is still working, that you're still doing things. But I'm also really interested in other people's interests. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find people fascinating. And I've, of course, got my own quirky little things that I learn little things about. And everybody's got, or at least in this community, everybody's got those areas. So where I might not think about, you know, historical cricket data as something that I would care about at all, somebody else's interest in that can make it interesting. And they can pick the parts out that would seem fascinating in an area you might not go down otherwise. So at the end of the day, I always think, oh, hey, I learned a thing. You know, way to go. Keep going. And hopefully I can share my interests with other people and do that same thing for them.
All right, we're talking to Jessamine West right now. We'll add another voice to the conversation. This is Deb Allen. She's a humorist for the New York Times, and she writes for their Wordplay blog. And on January 6th, she'll launch Buzzology, a weekly humor column on David Pogue's relaunch of his Yahoo tech site. Deb Amlin's been on our show many times. But Deb, you know, now you're on in the capacity, I guess, as somebody who participates in the world of puzzles and the world of people who solve crossword puzzles and work crossword puzzles, I guess that's one of the terms of art there. This is another area of random knowledge. You can't really study for a crossword puzzle, not specifically, right? The people who do these crossword puzzles.
It's
yeah.
It's not a test.
Yeah.
And I have to say that that's actually a fairly big part of my job in terms of writing about the crossword puzzle on a daily basis. There is, in most puzzles, there's always something really neat to learn, and that's one of my favorite parts of the job. I get to look up the things that, you know, so you don't have to. And, you know, truthfully, I'm not very smart, so I wind up looking up a lot of things. And, for example, today I was just writing about the puzzle that's coming out tonight, and I can't really spoil it, but there was a clue that I thought was really, really neat. I know that there are probably people listening who wouldn't like it if I spoiled it, but it was the object that I was referring to has a name in a different language.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that I didn't know that the name that it's been given and that we've all adopted meant what it did. So I looked it up, and it turns out that there are a lot of objects that go by different names that we've adopted in English and have meanings that we probably aren't even aware of.
Well, you know, I sometimes wonder about this, too, and I'm just an occasional dabbler in crossword puzzles, and I'll go months without doing one of them, so I don't really deserve any particular status in that community. But when I do work on them, I'm aware of the fact that a crossword puzzle and a lot of other puzzles like it depend on or at least sort of operate on a whole different set of understandings. In other words, you're trying to a certain degree to retrieve information that you have. And then to a certain degree, you're also encountering information that you don't have and trying to make some sense of it. And do you think, I mean, one of the prejudices, one of the perhaps unfair stereotypes against crossword puzzle doers, one hears, well, they don't really know that much more than anybody else. They just sort of know things. They know about Mel Ott because it's, you know, three letters, that kind of thing. Respond to that.
Well, you know, I think of my brain as a very big Tetris game. And I think that every time I try to stuff a new piece of information, another piece of information falls out. So what I probably knew a few years ago, I probably have done a huge brain dump on because I had to remember that Mel Ott was a baseball player that appears in crossword puzzles a lot. And everybody has a different degree of that. I had to learn that the Big Dipper is part of the Ursa Major because of crossword puzzles. I mean, there's a whole bunch of miscellanea and stuff that comes up that some people know and some people don't. And I think that the tough part that I think someone like Will Shortz, who edits the puzzle, has is trying to make sure that the clues and the entries and stuff, that there's something in it for everybody, because otherwise people don't have stand a chance of solving the puzzle. And, you know, ultimately we want them to be able to do that.
I mean, a crossword puzzle is a bunch of random information that then produces a kind of order. And crossword puzzles frequently, you know, are themed and have other ways of kind of suggesting order. But I'm going to go back to Jessamine West for a second here. And just I'm going to talk about an experience that I had. And I think I sent you a blog post that I wrote about it, because I think it sort of fits into this sort of the other kind of order. And I feel that those of us who are kind of compulsive researchers and people who, if we get interested in something, want to read lots of little bits and pieces of information about it, there's often this sense, as we're doing it, of incipient order, that if we just knew enough, you know, if we could just find five more pieces of information, we could really connect a lot of dots. You know, we would understand, you know, all the connections among 20 different fairly disparate historical figures. Or I mean, do you have that same reaction, or do people seeking your help as a librarian or in any of your other capacities exhibit that sort of belief that random information is always on the verge of coalescing into something more whole?
Well, I think the brain's job in some ways to sort of make patterns out of things, and that helps you see a random collection of sort of light impacting on your retina as a line or an edge or a this, that, or the other. And I think we can see that to extremes in people that, you know, grapple with mental illness or that grapple, you know, take recreational drugs. Suddenly you see a whole bunch of things there that weren't there before. Mm-hmm. And so that's one end. And then on the other end, there's just a pleasing sense to many people of order, patterns, and finding ways of grouping things. I mean, you're talking about crossword puzzles, which I'm really into, but I'm also really into Scrabble, like that tight, restricted, only certain rules, and then you've got to make the best you can of what's inside of it. I think the researching, especially when it's going to a specific end, when you want to compile information that goes to one thing. For you, it's your shows, your blog posts, and other things that you learn about. It's a natural thing that the brain does, and it can give us a sense of completion. I think we also see this in sort of the endless lists of the internet. You know, the 10 best thises or the 25 best thats or the 50 best these of 2013. People like to be able to complete the crossword puzzle, get all the way to the end, feel like they've got a set, for example. And I do think that's natural, normal, and it makes us happy. But I think part of it does come from an urge in the brain that has nothing to do with what the information is, but just the fact that we really like to assemble and order things because it helps us understand things, our brains, ourselves, that kind of thing.
You know, I guess I'm going to go back to you, Debbie Amlin, for a second and just say I'm sort of wondering about our status as thinking, sentient beings, those of us who have a fondness for miscellaneous or uncategorizable information.
Right.
And I mean, you know, I was at a brunch yesterday, and there was a guy there I know. His name is Matt Warschauer. He's a historian. He's an expert in particular in Connecticut during the Civil War. He got involved when Joe Courtney and Tony Kushner were having a fight about a detail in Lincoln. But he knows a lot about this one thing, and it is sort of Irving Berlin's fox and hedgehog thing. He's a hedgehog. He knows a lot about it. But I think also he retains a lot about it because he's only trying to learn about this thing. I mean, Matt has lots of other interests. But the thing he knows about, I think he retains a lot of information. And I wonder about people like you and me, and maybe also Jessamine. I wonder if we keep as much information in our head because it's not all about one thing, so it kind of doesn't have little friends to cling to. I mean, it may get washed away more easily.
I think you're right about that, which is why I tend to forget so much. But the nice thing about that is that there's always so much more to learn. One of my favorite, you had been talking about Metafilter and Boing Boing. One of my favorite websites about things like this in trivia is called Twisted Sifter. And every day, it really is like a slot machine. You sort of pull the handle and you get all these really neat things that you had no idea about. Micro house building and why Iceland is apparently an abstract painting. I mean, really weird stuff that doesn't fit anywhere, but is really cool to learn. And I think also people like to appear knowledgeable. So when you have a website like this, and they make it very easy to share it in social media so that you can say, hey, look, isn't this neat? I mean, you know, and I know about it, and now you can know about it too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's increasingly that whole idea of people liking to appear knowledgeable, and so much of my information and perceptions, unfortunately, come from movies. And I'm thinking of, you know, of Quiz Show, in which Ralph Fiennes is playing Charles Van Doren, you know, and it's really at a time when people like America as a whole, as a mass audience, really, really got excited about guys like Herbie Stemple and Charles Van Doren, who would go on these shows and answer much more difficult questions than I think are asked these days on Jeopardy and shows like that.
And it continues today. I mean, we have Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and we have Ask Me Another right on NPR.
But you don't have to know a lot to do well on those shows. You have to be able to come, you have to finish a Monkees lyric.
And I would know, because I tanked miserably on it. But I have to say, it's a lot of fun. You know, it's really nerve-wracking when you're up there. But this is why I think pub trivia is so popular these days. People love to get together, and, you know, it's the new sport. We're using our brains to sort of butt antlers together rather than, you know, beat each other up.
We're talking to Deb Amlin right now about this. So, Jessamyn West, I'm going to go back to you. You know, I'm going to go cite another movie reference here. That is, there's this movie called The Edge, where Anthony Hopkins and Alec Baldwin are among some people who are plane wrecked in some remote area of Alaska. And it turns out that Anthony Hopkins, although he's like a millionaire businessman or something, he's also this guy who, you know, he's a Jessamyn West kind of guy. You know, he just knows a lot about a lot of things. And he's never really been in the wilderness before, but he knows how to make a compass out of a pine needle. I mean, he knows all kinds of things. And I mean, do you feel, and as a result, he is better equipped to survive than Alec Baldwin, who doesn't know anything. And do you feel that way? Do you feel like knowing a lot of diverse information is ultimately as useful as immersing yourself in one thing? Is it as useful to be a fox as it is to be a hedgehog?
Well, I think society needs both, right? I mean, I think it's good to know a lot about a lot of things because you never know what you're going to need in any particular circumstance. But I think you've got a fairly good idea that survival skills are going to be really useful in a way that maybe baseball statistics wouldn't be. And I, of course, caveat that with, you know, the social skills of knowing, of having and sharing information are huge. But I do think people know sort of what's important and what's not important. But I think, you know, just like society needs people who sort of travel and go away and come back and tell you about those places, society also needs people who stay in one place and who build sort of that community. I think, I mean, I hate for the answer to be like, well, it depends. but at the end of the day, I think you need lots of both sorts of people. And one of the weird things about being a librarian in this century is I feel like I know less also. And partly that's because I've shifted to from just knowing things, just having lists of facts at my disposal, to knowing where to find things. I mean, with a smartphone in your pocket, if you can look a thing up, you may not want to store that thing in your brain if you're not going to need it, at least if you're going to be somewhere with cell service. And I've shifted sort of my inside my brain categorization to account for that. But I think in some ways, many of us know less because we know where to find the thing that we remember we knew, but maybe don't have it quite at our fingertips, which isn't a lot of help if you're in a plane crash in Alaska.
Right. Although I think, first of all, that's a perfect shift into our next segment with David Weinberger. That's exactly where we need to go. I think I'd rather be in the Alaska wilderness with you than with Neil deGrasse Tyson, because, I mean, he's really, really smart. But, you know, anything that's not at least 100 miles above the Earth's surface, he's not going to know that much about. Whereas there's a good chance you might know something that would get us out. All right. Even if you couldn't look it up. All right. We're going to just grab one quick call. Oh, no, we're going to take a break. I hear break music. We'll take a break. We'll get to the calls. John from Kensington, Gloria from West Hartford. Just hang in there with us. Thanks to Deb Amlin. Jessamyn's staying. David Weinberger's coming. I feel like I'm an air traffic controller here. All right, we're back. We're talking about useless information, miscellanea, marginalia, trivia. I know, I don't like that word. But you know what I'm talking about. And we're talking about whether it's sort of essentially valuable. What does it mean if you have a lot of it, if you're drawn to it? What are the joys and allures of it? Maybe it also just exists the way John Ruskin said that art exists, that he said some of the most beautiful things in the world are useless. And maybe information is kind of beautiful in its own way. And I think also, by the way, I've just exhibited some useless information that I can quote John Ruskin on that subject. All right. So we got some great calls here on the board. John from Kensington, Gloria from West Hartford. We'll get to you in just a second. We're going to add to the conversation David Weinberger. He's the author of, among other books, Everything is Miscellaneous, and hence his presence on this show. He's co-director of the Harvard Library Innovation Lab. So David Weinberger, even listening to some of this conversation, let's go back to something that Jessamyn and I said at the beginning, which was that, you know, in libraries, which exist at least partly still in physical space, you know, there's cataloging that goes on. And I think she said, you know, you want all the books about the Bible and the Bible itself and so, to be in physical proximity to one another. But one of the things that you've essentially argued is that since information increasingly exists in digital space and in a profusion undreamt of by physical librarians of the past, it really doesn't make sense to think about it that way, or at least it doesn't make sense to depend on that kind of grouping anymore. And I'll ask you to elaborate.
Well, yes. So first of all, hi, Jessamine. You know I'm a big fan. So, you do want all the Bibles together if you are looking for all the Bibles, which is a pretty common way that people are going to browse. It's a very sensible thing to do. But because in a physical library you are dealing with physical books, the categorization continues to be hugely important, but what looked like a benefit, the ability to put all the Bibles on a single shelf, turns out to be a benefit but also a limitation in the age of the digital. So having all the Bibles together is one way of categorizing those books. But each of those books has multiple ways that it might be understood, how it might be categorized. And in fact, librarians, catalogers do provide multiple categories for almost every book that they assign categories to. The problem with physical space is you have to pick one. And you pick the one that's going to be most useful to your users. Librarians are fantastic at that. But then you also help guide them to the set of categories that they come in interested in. And librarians, by the way, are also fantastic at that. In a digital space, you don't have to pick a single way of categorizing. So if it's you and your spouse trying to figure out how to organize your books or your CDs, if you still have CDs or whatever, and one of you wants to do it alphabetically and another one wants to do it chronologically, only one of you can win because you're dealing with physical objects. But if you're dealing with digital objects, like your digital music collection, you can have as many different playlists as you want, and each one expresses a different way of thinking about the materials, a different way of bringing together these items in ways that may be may say something important about those items. You may see connections that you had otherwise wouldn't have seen. So digitally, we don't have to – digitally cataloging, categorizing, still hugely important. They express a great deal of information. But you're not limited to picking the one that you will use. You can have as many, many, many as you want. And that is an enormous enrichment of how we understand our world.
And obviously it allows you to ask and have answered with a certain amount of ease very different kinds of questions than one could ask in the past, or at least one could ask and get easy access to information about. So, yes, you can have all the Bibles and the books about the Bible grouped in one place. But now you can ask, well, who are the five most important figures in history or literature named David, present company accepted, and begin to sort of cross-cut through large amounts of information that way. And so obviously one of them is probably King David in the Bible, and who knows who the other four are. But you can begin to research that in a very different way, whereas a 13th century scholastic, you know, Erasmus or somebody, could all he could really look at over and over again was the Bible and other kinds of related texts. And I can see where that's really promising and useful. It also obviously conjures up the prospect of people like me wasting huge amounts of time pursuing things that ultimately don't really have any significance or meaning.
Well, yes. I mean, so I completely agree with Jessamine about what the brain's role in this is. And all that I would add is that the brain, we seem not to just to be creatures that make sense of things by drawing connections, seeing what thing is alike another, is like another, where we get to choose what the likeness is. We're also creatures that are driven by interest, what we find interesting. And I think, Colin, that may be one of the reasons why you have backed off using the word trivia, and I'm glad that you did, is that we cannot predict what's going to be interesting to other people. And when you categorize, you are making that prediction. When you categorize in a physical world where there's only going to be one primary way of sorting the shelves you're going to walk past, you're making a very important decision about how you think the world is interesting to others. But we absolutely cannot predict what's going to be interesting. For example, if I were to say, we know why dictionaries are useful and interesting, but if I were to say, why don't we make a dictionary of two-letter words? If you're not a Scrabble player, then you will see no reason for that. But if you are, a dictionary of two-letter words is actually really useful and helpful. We cannot predict what is going to be interesting and useful to others. In the digital world, we don't have to. Every time we make a connection, we make a categorization, we tag something, we create a link, we are adding to the world's collection of ways in which things go together, which opens up that world to anybody's unpredictable interests.
Right now, our guests are David Weinberger and Jessamine West. I'm going to grab a call or two here, and we'll start with John in Kensington. Hi, John.
Hi. I was going to say that listening to NPR is a collection of random thoughts because the host picks the topic. You never know what's going to be on, and you tune in and you collect information randomly.
Well, I think that that's really true, and true even of our morning and afternoon drive shows, Morning Edition and All Things Considered, that that things are maybe more so than other news sources. Things are miscellaneously lumped in together. In other words, you'll jump from some hard news international reporting about Syria to something about music to something that really kind of amounts to a human interest story. And Jessamine, once again, I think that goes back. It's not like we invented this brilliant form. We're just responding to this basic human need that human brains seem to want, just the way human bodies want a fairly diverse diet with certain multiple requirements. Human brains seem to want to have a lot of different kind of information.
Well, and once you're past the sort of information you need to keep yourself alive, then, yeah, a lot of people take different paths to what they want to do with their brain sort of the rest of the time. Serendipitous browsing, whether it's through the radio, through the library, or just through your backyard and looking at different trees, is something that I think has always been on the human pleasure matrix once they've been able to branch out to things that weren't just survival.
You know, David Weinberger, this digital phenomenon is still relatively new. You know, we're really the first couple of generations to be immersed in it. Have you thought much about what the structure of knowledge will be like 25, 30, 50 years from now? In other words, given the fact that now people can begin to seek out common elements that wouldn't have been evident to them, look for patterns that wouldn't be obvious if you were just dealing one single source at a time. Is knowledge going to, maybe it already does look a lot different. I don't know. Is knowledge going to be a different thing, a different creature 50 years from now?
Simple little question.
Yeah.
But I think we are actually in the midst of a huge change in the nature of knowledge. And I think it actually can be tied directly back to the question of cataloging and categories, because for about 2,500 years in the West, we assumed that to know what something is to give it a definition. You have to know its definition, otherwise you don't know what it is. And definition expresses where that thing is in the order of the universe. It's that these concepts in the past 100 years have gotten a little more foreign, but this was the dominant idea in our culture, that to know what something is to know its place, its single place in the order. Everything had one place. And so we'd have arguments about what was essential about a thing and what wasn't. This expresses exactly the limitation that the physical world imposes upon us. So you have to decide where you're going to put the book if you're shelving it as a librarian, what category, what shelf you're going to put it on. It can only go in one place. And we've imported that limitation that everything has a single place in this order into the world of ideas. And we formed our notion of knowledge from that. And over the past 100 years, and especially in the past 20 years, we're seeing this enormous break where we don't think that there is a single order of the universe that's been carved in stone, so to speak. We instead have a much more supple and I think more realistic understanding that of the multiple ways in which things can go together. But that really changes what we think it is to know something.
You know, I continue to feel there are some subjects that I've sort of collected a certain amount of random and useless information about, where I do continue to feel as though I'm on the verge of something. That, you know, if I could know, as I said to Jessamine a little while ago, if I could know one or two more things. I'll give you an example, too. So Richard Bissell, who was the architect of the Bay of Pigs fiasco, he was a very important guy in the CIA, and it was his big mistake was the Bay of Pigs fiasco, was born in what is now the Mark Twain house, and what was Mark Twain's actual house. But there was sort of an intervening period between the time Mark Twain lived there and the time it became a museum, when just regular people lived there. So he was born in the Mark Twain house. I've subsequently found out he was one of the architects also of Area 51, the famous place where, you know, all the secret stuff goes on. And I, you know, I feel as I accumulate information about Richard Bissell that somehow or other I eventually will be able to connect the fact that he was born in the Mark Twain house to some of this other real. Oh, he also invented the U-2 spy plane. It was one of the reasons he got all the power in the CIA to be able to make a mistake like the Bay of Pigs fiasco. But there's this kind of almost an illusion we have, I think, that the dots are ultimately connectable. If we could just kind of know enough. And we now live in an environment where we can pursue that kind of information, where we can maybe even find out whether there's some connection between seemingly unconnected things. And David Weinberger, I'm babbling, first of all, and I apologize for that. But second of all, in some ways, that's not that different from what scholastic activity has been like for centuries and centuries, right? I mean, you know, every great scholar is looking for connections. Is it just that it could happen at a much higher speed now? I think in your book, you talk about how the Library of Congress gets, 7,000 books a day, but the web gets, 75 million pages loaded up to it?
Well, so finding patterns does seem to be something that is deeply enjoyable to people, and maybe it's in our genes. So when a pattern emerges, it makes us happy. We like that. The problem is that all dots can always be connected. Mm-hmm. They don't always make sense, but you can always connect dots. And so we have throughout our history tried to find these patterns and connect them. We have, in the case of the sciences and the other scholarly pursuits, tried to insist that we only want to connect the dots that actually go together. And we could, you know, you can write a Dan Brown novel about Richard Bissell, and I have learned far more about Richard Bissell than I ever knew before, so thank you very much, Colin. You could write a Dan Brown in which it turns out the Illuminati is the connection between the dots, and that would be sort of fun to read maybe, but there's no truth to it. We've had the sense that there is a right way to connect dots, that there are patterns that are real and have tremendous priority. And in some instances, in some cases, that's correct. I mean, science is about finding those patterns. But now we have so many dots and so many different ways of putting them together. Some of them we do simply for enjoyment, and some we make truth claims about. And it's really important to be clear about what you are doing when you're doing it.
Well, and I mean, I think the lesson of this, one of the object lessons of this in modern history is the Kennedy assassination, where, in fact, there was this national desire to know what happened. So what was brought to bear on the question was every bit of information and forensic technology that could be found, every possibility of evidence gathering that could be found, data analysis. I mean, really, you know, the best we had at that moment. And the profusion of information, actually, I think at a certain point became a problem in the way that you're suggesting, David Weinberger, and in the way that you're suggesting that if you have enough information, you can construct multiple mutually exclusive scenarios that use certain numbers of just if you have enough facts, you can make up a scenario that makes a certain amount of sense, but isn't actually true.
Yeah, so I'm very positive.
Too, right?
Say that again, Jessamyn.
Find ways of testing hypotheses in ways that we all sort of agree can get you to conclusions that people tend to agree on, the scientific method, as opposed to the, here's a bunch of dots I connected, what do you think? I've got a web page.
David, what were you going to say?
First of all, that's completely agree, and it's a really it's very important to keep that in mind, that we have some disciplines that have well-established ways of making connections and verifying them. But I think I'm very positive and optimistic about this flowering of connectivity of the miscellaneous, the multiple ways of reading the miscellaneous. But one of the things that worries me a great deal is that I think that the internet has provided empirical evidence that even though there are ways of – science is generally right. Science is a good thing to do, and we should believe it for scientific matters. The internet shows us that we simply are – as a set of world cultures, we are not going to agree. We used to hope for a long time. We've hoped that if we just sit down with the facts and we agree what the facts are and we see how they go together, and we form hypotheses and we do science, that we'll come up with agreement. Everybody will agree. But we do that, and we see that there is still never-ending disagreement. And I think that maybe one of the lessons we should be learning just empirically is that, no, we're not going to agree, and we're going to have to deal with a world that is in profound disagreement with itself about some very important issues.
And this is like a whole other conversation, and I'm already getting the sign to wrap up this segment, so I shouldn't bring it up. But maybe in a minute or two, we can just deal with this. In some ways, one of the testing grounds for a lot of this is Wikipedia, because in Wikipedia, because you know, knowledge is iterative in Wikipedia. You know, one person can replace another person's knowledge with their knowledge, and there's this sort of utopian hope that it will average out correctly, that ultimately things that are true will prevail under these circumstances. But to me, that's still kind of in the testing phase, you know, that we can arrive at knowledge that way, that by everybody's best efforts, we can come up with a better knowledge model. But David, I know this is something you look at a lot more than I do, so I'll let you have the last word about it.
Well, so I love Wikipedia. I find it incredibly useful. It does fill me with hope. Nevertheless, it succeeds at what it does rather spectacularly because, first of all, it has a set of rules that it has worked out very carefully for a process, much like, in some ways, like the scientific process, a process for resolving disputes. And it has a hidden agreement. People who thoroughly disagree with Wikipedia and what its approach, they don't participate. Creationists don't participate. And so we do end up with a good page, thankfully, at Wikipedia on evolution, but it has implicitly excluded from participation people who profoundly agree with it. So there's a sort of a hidden sameness that allows Wikipedia to come to agreement on so many pages.
All right. That's a whole conversation for another day. I want to teach a whole course on Wikipedia. I'm trying to talk Trinity College into letting me do it. We have to take a little break here. We want to thank David Weinberger very much. Jessamyn West is going to stay with us as we get ready to talk to Steve Silverman, who's a high school science teacher, author of Einstein's Refrigerator. He records the Useless Information podcast.
Who invented bacon? Sir Francis Bacon, Friar Roger Bacon, or Lord Oscar Mayer? It's a trick question. Bacon was invented by the 13th century scholastics Lettuce and Tomato. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. The part of Bill Curry was played by John Stuart Mill. For links, articles, photos, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff reading encyclopedias on the toilet, go to our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the nose plows through the snow for a lunch of Walmart five-spice Chinese donkey meat. And now, back to Colin.
It is, by the way, possible to visit our excellent website, WNPR.org, without encountering pictures of the Faith Middleton Show staff reading encyclopedias on the toilet, should you wish to avoid that site. All right, so let me grab one quick call here. We got a lot to cover, and as usual, we're running out of time. Breakneck speed. Here's Gloria in West Hartford. Hi, Gloria.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, you talk about information. We absorb information all the time.
True.
What your mind does with it is another thing.
The important
thing is access.
Yeah, so you have access to all of it. Although, you know, she makes an interesting point, Jessamyn West, but you know, I mean, even getting ready for the show, and I was working on this little song here, and so I started looking for something that rhymed with Greenwich, and that was spinach, and then I found out Catherine de' Medici actually had decreed she wanted spinach for every meal, and that's why we call things Florentine, because she was from Florence. If it has spinach in it, it's Florentine. And then I started reading about her son, Henry III, and I realized I could pass this wonderful, pleasurable day just following all these little research trails down. But I also wondered, I mean, I don't know, is it kind of a drug? I wondered where I would be at the end of all that. You know, would I be a better person? Would I be a smarter person? Or would I have sort of wasted a lot of time pursuing information that doesn't really have any utility for me?
Well, I think that's between you and your own personal moral compass, right? I mean, you seem to have determined that this doesn't have utility for you, but it becomes part of your job. It's part of something that makes you happy. It makes you enjoyable to other people because you can make these songs and people enjoy them. And you know, I think part of it is really setting expectations for why you want to be doing the stuff. I mean, obviously, if you're losing hours and you wake up and you haven't brushed your teeth or done the things you wanted to do, it's getting in your way. But other than that, it sounds like a hobby, and it sounds like something that's completely appropriate way to spend your time, as long as you're not bothering yourself about it, in which case you have to look in the mirror and sort of figure out what it is that you want if it's not this.
Right.
To me, it's an end of the means. It's bar trivia information. It's pub trivia information. It's fun stuff to talk to my neighbors about. It's partly my job. It's keeping myself an informed citizen. And all of those things have value in their own little it's being making posts on Metafilter. They all have their own micro value, I guess you would say, and you can sort of combine those to create a life.
I am vastly reassured by everything that you just said. Thank you so much, Josephine West. Hey, we have just some time for Steve Silverman. As I said, he's the author of Einstein's Refrigerator. He records the Useless Information podcast. Steve Silverman, tell us what that podcast is.
Very hard to categorize. As you said, this kind of information doesn't fit into any category. In fact, when I was trying to find a category to put into on iTunes, it didn't fit into any. It's really just stories that interest me, the very, very obscure things from history, things I'd say that kind of fit Andy Warhol's 15 minutes of fame and then they're forgotten about. And usually they're between, say, 1920 to 1960 or so. And they're things that are forgotten about, and I just kind of bring them back to life, and just very, very unusual stories from history.
Just to give an example, talk about the fake epidemic, the typhus story.
That one's from World War II. It took place in 1939. There were two doctors, Dr. Matulowicz and Dr. Lazowski. And there was this young man. He was on leave from a Nazi work camp, and he did not want to go back to the work camp. He knew that if he went back, it would mean slave labor and possible death. And he knew the only way not to go back was either to get some sort of serious disease or to commit suicide, and obviously that was not an option. So he mentioned this to Dr. Matulowicz, and Matulowicz came up with a really ingenious solution. He remembered back in college that if he was injected with Proteus OX19 or 0X19, it's a harmless soil microbe, that the body would produce an antibody the same as for typhus. So he decided to try. He injected this guy with this microbe, and sure enough, they sent it off to the German lab, and he tested positive for typhus. So they decided these two doctors decided to start injecting anyone that came to their offices with this harmless microbe. And next thing you know, the Germans, they were so fearful of a typhus outbreak that they quarantined 12 villages, and they saved about I estimate about 8,000 lives from the concentration camps.
That's an amazing story. And the next time that you tell it,
I'm telling it pretty quickly, so I'm kind of stumbling through it.
You did an excellent job of telling it. Although the next time you tell it, you can actually mention that quarantine actually does come from old Venetian dialect, and it comes from a Venetian dialect phrase that meant 40 days, and it was I think came out during the Black Plague, during the time of the plague, and it wasn't so much Venice, but it was nearby cities like Dubrovnik, where ships were made to stay outside for 40 days to make sure that they weren't carrying in plague or some kind of other disease. So that's my useless information.
Yeah, so we're both learning something here.
And so, I mean, how do you feel about the word useless? Obviously, it's a catchy phrase to use for the title of your thing.
Well, you know, at the end of every story, every podcast I do, I just say useless, useful. I'll leave that for you to decide. Because some people really do send me emails that they're really offended by the fact that I say it's useless information, because, you know, some of these stories are quite important, or they're quite moving to people. And, you know, to me, there's a lot of these stories are things that, it's kind of like reading the newspaper. You read the story, and, it may be important one day, but a week later it doesn't mean too much to you. And that's how I see it. They're kind of interesting. They may be, something with a nice twist to them, something you never thought that could happen, or something that it was just very, very unbelievable. But it may not have much of an impact on your life, but maybe to somebody it does. So useless, it doesn't really matter in the end. What's useless to one person could be very useful to somebody else. I think that's for each person to judge.
All right. Well, we've come to the end of our show, and Jessamyn West, you've already summed up the spirit of the show beautifully with your previous comment. So we've got 30 seconds left. Do you want to give us one example of either useful or useless information you've encountered in the last few days? What's the last most recent thing?
I don't even know if it's in the last few days. Of course, the things that I learned just on this show, but whenever people ask me, like, oh, trivia, you like trivia? What? Tell me some trivia. I'm always like, well, did you know that most armadillos have identical quadruplets, and they're one of the only animals that gets leprosy? And, then we can start on a discussion of leprosy, or a discussion of armadillos, or a discussion of identical twins, and you know, for conversation kickoffs, it's a decent one.
Oh, that's a great
for
one.
For conversation wrap-ups, I don't know.
Right, no, we're working on a Twins show right now, so that's actually very helpful to us. And I agree that also it's the follow-up, really. It isn't the fact, the trivia, the you know, it's the follow-up. It's, you know, to Steve's story, that would be the questions about typhus or questions about World War II that you would ask afterwards, the other armadillo questions that you would ask. So that's the last message we'll leave you with. It's not just that one thing about the armadillo. Ask all the other questions about the thing about the armadillo.
I'm Kyone Wolf. Did you know the word facetious contains all five vowels in alphabetical order? Vowels. They think they're so... Yeah, it's hard to be facetious about the alphabet.